Yeah.
Thank you, sir. So it is 1 o'clock. This is a convening, a regular meeting of the San Juan County Public Hospital District Number 1. Today's date is Wednesday, March 27th, and it's, again, 1 o'clock. First agenda item is agenda approval, which is specific to today's agenda. Does the board hear a motion to approve it as written? Second?
It's not as written.
Thank you. All in favor?
Discussion? Head of the airport.
Well, the orders, the chair can orchestrate that.
Fine.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And as Rebecca mentioned, we changed the order just a little bit to accommodate schedules, particularly Evan's role as a schedule that has been approved. So, and then the next agenda item is the consent agenda. Can I hear a motion to approve that?
I'll make the motion to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Thank you. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Very good. So we're going to have our outside or special reports first, as I mentioned just a second ago. The first one is going to be presented by Evan Perez. Evan is a member of the Iran Healthcare Foundation, which is a 501c3 that is has consented to be the main conduit for funds to fund a feasibility study done by Jody Corona. And Evans also was a chair of the task force that addressed trying to restore the services lost by the Life Care Centers of America, i.e. convalescent homes. So he has been a champion of this effort to get the ball rolling at this stage of the game and to restore long-term care for particularly the elderly folks. Mr. Perez, stage is yours, sir.
Thank you. Just as kind of a quick background, and I know most of you know this, but when LifeCare closed, we formed a task force that consisted of approximately 10 to 11 individuals. They came together for a period of about 8 or 9 months with the concept of kind of blue skying what we felt were the immediate needs for our county. And in the course of that, actually, as we were coming to our conclusions, we learned that there were a group of public hospital districts very similar to this one in rural areas that had gotten together and were actually conducting pretty much the same process that we were. This particular public hospital district was, I believe, the 12th or 13th member to join. Ultimately, there's 13 different public hospital districts that are part of that. And the fascinating thing to me is as we were pursuing this and joining with that consortium, we found that our conclusions were actually almost identical, if not identical, to what they had come up with. It was also during this period that we learned that there was an opportunity for us to apply for our HRSA grant to secure funding to help pay for some of the things that we were proposing, a feasibility study, which I'll get to in a moment. And we actually ultimately did not pursue the HRSA grant because it had already been granted to the network that we joined. That network has kind of slowed down their progress, and we are in an opportunity right now where we as a county can really be the leaders of that program. And so right now we're kind of at a critical stage. We have secured the services of Jody Corona with Healthcare Facilities Planning and Development to construct a feasibility study. I've given you just kind of a quick two-page document that covers some of the talking points of exactly what we're looking to do, and I'll just briefly go through that. We agree that the feasibility study must address the magnitude and extent of long-term care service needs on each island, an identification of programs to address the needs and currently available reimbursements. To the extent practical, the goal is to build off the work of the community-based long-term care network, which was the 13 rural public hospital districts. And it should be noted again, just to refresh everybody's memory, they're experiencing the exact same issues that we are. Almost, I think, exclusively each of the 13 public hospital districts have lost access to a skilled nursing facility. They are struggling with mental health availability. They're struggling with home health, with home care. They're struggling with affordable housing. And they're also really struggling with the payer sources, Medicaid versus Medicare, and proper reimbursements. We've identified the service mix as a deconstructed PACE services with network-level RN care coordination, telemonitoring, behavioral health, community health workers embedded in primary care clinics, home health through primary care clinics with day health, caregiver support, home safety renovations, and transportation. We did look at pretty exclusively at the greenhouse model, which will be further evaluated during the feasibility study. And again, the greenhouse project started probably about 10 years ago. They have over 100, basically I refer to them as micro nursing homes. And they take anywhere from 8 to 12 people, that's the limit. And as part of our initial blue sky with the task force, we identified that it would really be a perfect infrastructure for each of the main islands, Orcas, Lopez, and here. It also will address capital with startup and staffing requirements, analysis of the costs and revenues associated with each proposed program. There's a big piece in there about governance. That's been kind of a hotbed issue as to who will actually own this project and take it from start to completion and manage it once it is in place. Identification of criteria that will be used internally and publicly to measure and report those successes. So in essence, what we're trying to do is identify currently available countywide and district-specific data, as well as the data from other sources, which primarily at this point would be DSHS, and analyze analysis for resident needs and gaps, estimate volumes specific to each district and to the county at large. We'll be conducting a series of community meetings, focus groups, and surveys of seniors, caregivers, and providers, developing a consensus on service needs and a care model, developing underlying assumptions for pro formas, including the timing of service initiation and the volumes, staffing, including salaries and benefits, payer mixes, reimbursement, other expenses as they come up, and capital expenditures. Part of Jody's group, they'll be developing a pro forma with quantifying startup costs and operating deficits under one or more ownership or operation models, and identifying governance models, and finally finalizing a report with recommendations, including ways to accelerate startup. I did include in the bottom of that piece for you just exactly kind of what it's going to cost. We're estimating right now the cost of this feasibility study, which will take probably 4 or 5 months, to be about $50,000. Thus far, we've raised about $10,000. We did receive a small kind of grant stipend from the network that I discussed earlier, and we've raised some private funds, but at this point, we're still quite a bit short. My hope, ultimately, is I'll be asking each public hospital district, I have meetings set with Lopez and Orcas, that we're hoping that you would be interested in contributing about $10,000 each to help cover the cost of our study. That's it.
Very good. Thank you, Evan. Any questions or comments? So we'll start with you, Dr. Mark.
I think we need to support this. The need hasn't gone away. I think it's only going to increase. We need to get ahead of it as far as we can. A lot of time's gone by since the closure of the Life Care Center. So I would support funding research. The professional hour rate is kind of high, but I guess that's just the going rate these kind of organizations.
Honestly, Mark, our hope is Jody's doing quite a bit of work with Peace Health right now. They are doing their, I believe it's their biannual research. Our hope is that we can piggyback on some of that and reduce the costs a little bit. But ultimately, this is a, you know, and I just say this personally, this is a very critical stage, not only for our county, but for our country. My understanding is we've lost about 14 nursing homes in Seattle alone over the last year and a half. That number is going to get worse as there's more nursing homes teetering on the verge of collapse. We have an opportunity to, I really believe, blaze new trails. I believe that Jody is on board with what we've talked about and discussed, and this is an opportunity for us to really put together something very unique, but really serve the needs of this community.
You mentioned that the final number isn't known, the final expense. Is $10,000 a hard number for us?
Doesn't have to be.
You can go higher if you want. Okay, Lisa.
I agree with Mark. I think this is critical for our community.
Very good. Rebecca?
Me too, and when we're done discussing, I'd like to make a motion about it.
Okay. I'll pass for the time being. Dr. Appleton, any comments, sir?
You're $40,000 short of what you anticipate needing. So each of us gave 10, 3, 30, that's 40. Where's the other 10 coming from? My point being, if you start, you want to finish. So where's your plan to get the other 10?
We do have some people in the community that have expressed interest, and I feel pretty confident that I would be able to go to them and close the gap on that. Unless you would be willing to put in more, that's completely up to you. We've been very lucky. Jody has been very gracious, and they've started their work on this project without receiving payment at this point. At some point, I do need to make sure that we've got the money to pay for it. The challenge for me, and to be honest, and just the fundraising, is this is not the most sexy thing to be involved in. As soon as I start talking about feasibility study, people kind of glaze over a little bit. But the reality is, this community knows how important it is, and I feel pretty confident that I'll be able to close that.
Yeah, I put my two cents on. You know, it seems like every other time I show up at the produce department, at the market, I get approached by people who are very concerned, who have parents who are missing the convalescent center here locally, have to relocate to the mainland, and they've brought up just point blank, hey, you know, I'm willing to contribute money to this. You just get the ball rolling. And this second point I'd like to make is Jody Corona was a fundamental part of the design and execution of Peace Island Medical Center. She knows her business. She has, you know, a reputation within the state of Washington that is just beyond fantastic. So we have the right person, and we need to fund it, and I'm sure, as Evan said, that one way or the other, we will get that 50 grand. Rebecca?
So I'd like to make a motion to support the Inner Island Healthcare Foundation and Evan and their efforts to support the restoration of long-term care in San Juan County. And in addition to that, to offer our financial support consistent with that contributed by the other PhDs.
Would you put a cap on that?
I wouldn't, but the other PhDs are probably not going to be able to pay much more than that anyway. I mean, if they come up with 15.
So we're out of order. You know, let's call for a second.
Well, let's just try to massage the motion.
Well, that's generally reserved for the discussion period.
Okay, fair.
Yeah.
So, Evan, the ask is $10,000, right?
Correct.
So, did we hear a second?
Yeah.
Oh, you seconded.
I seconded it. That's what I did.
Oh, very good.
I didn't speak loud enough.
Okay. And I got new hearing aids.
Yeah, too, I got it. So I got it. Yeah, I know. So, I'm used to it.
Well, I'm going to turn the volume up just because of you. Okay, very good. So, that opens the discussion period. And Dr. Moore?
Yeah, that was the discussion.
Okay, very good. You know, I'm fully supportive of this. Matter of fact, we have a letter of support from Dr. Diamond's Board of Health in the name of their chair, Dr. Heisinger, that the PhD just recently obtained. They didn't mention anything in terms of money, in terms of their contribution, but we're a taxing entity, and we do have a few dollars in the piggy bank, so I fully support this motion. Any other comments? Call for a vote. All in favor?
So we're just restate the motion as
it hasn't been modified.
Yeah, has it been modified?
No.
Match
no.
The others. Then I would just get rid of matching the others and just say $10,000 and let them match us. And then Evan has some more weight going into the next two meetings to say, this is what the cheap guys on San Juan did, so can you beat them? You know, or whatever. But I wouldn't get into this. They're going to say, well, they're going to match us. What are we, you know, this matching thing doesn't seem to work very well in my estimation. I just say
understood.
$10,000, and if you start running short, you'll come back and tell us what great progress, and you need another shuckload too. That's the
fair
way
enough.
I look at it.
I believe, however, that since it's countywide, that our we cannot ask our taxpayers to pay more into it than the other two islands who are getting the same benefit. Otherwise, that would be unfair.
Well, it's good they get public funds, and we went through this specifically.
We did once before.
With regards to the protocols, the BLS-ALS protocol. So I think we're kind of beholden to make it a matching fund just because of that proviso. And I think that's probably the basis of the way you wrote your motion.
We could put a cap on it, but that caps no well, more than.
Yeah, I would say that commensurate with the equal contributions of the other PhDs and up to an amount of $10,000, or let's just call it $10,000. So if they don't pony up, the other public hospital districts don't contribute, as you say, we cannot of our own kick in the 10 grand. We have to have their participation as well, is my understanding.
Yeah, basically it's gifting and public funds. Same sort of thing, different phraseology.
Okay. Or we could say $10,000 contingent upon the other two islands.
Yeah, and so Rebecca, could you
put it in $10,000? And that way it's contingent upon Evan's work of convincing.
So in addition to offer our financial support consistent with that contributed by the other county PhDs, that's what it was. And then you say in the amount of $10,000, or say to support and to offer our financial support of $10,000
contingent
on the other two. Contingent on matching funds from the other county PhDs.
I would support that we earmark $10,000 contingent on the other two islands coming in with that. And that way you have some negotiating power. We want this to go forward. We don't want to be sitting here, you know, we'll do seven. I don't want an auction going on. We're taking up time and resources.
Well, I think that motion does that, because it's saying we're offering our financial support of $10,000 contingent on matching funds by the other county PhDs. So that says we'll do it if they do it. Then you can sell it.
Fair enough.
So we've amended your original motion. So why don't you reread it, and then we can rule on the amended motion.
Okay, the whole motion is to support the Inner Island Healthcare Foundation and Evan in their efforts to support the restoration of long-term care in San Juan County, in addition to offer our financial support of $10,000 contingent on matching funds from the other county PhDs.
Okay. Second for the amended motion?
Second.
Very good. Any further discussion?
If the only other, you know, if it's the whole county, it's two other PhDs, that's three islands out of So if we're going on it's the whole county thing, so it all has to be equal, what are we going to do with the other islands? That gets into that legal question of giving gifts and all that kind of stuff. But I can go with this, and if you need more, you can come back, and we'll argue it at that time. But.
Any further comments? Call for a vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Passes unanimously. Very good.
Thank you.
And thank you so much, and good luck, sir.
And if we can help you, let us know.
Thank you. We need all the help I can get.
Yeah, but he needs help convincing.
He does need a lot of help. That was a joke.
You're going to turn your pyramids down.
Yeah. Now you can go to your other meeting.
Thank you.
Okay.
And thank you for all your work.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Next up is a report, an educational report, presentation, basically, for not only PhD board commissions, but also for our community. It's basically revisiting a consideration that was struck here a couple of years ago. More recently, Peace Health, Peace Island, has consented to restudy this proposal, and the proposal relates to a potential second helipad in juxtapositioning to Peace Island Medical Center, ED. The presenter is Scott Zander and his compatriots. Scott?
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for having us out. Special congratulations to Chief Martin for retiring April 1st, I understand.
Yeah. Thank you.
So my name is Scott. I've been to several meetings before. I'm a flight nurse from Bellingham. I'm the base manager there in Bellingham, and I've been a flight nurse out in the San Juan Islands for 13, 14 years now. We love coming out here, San Juan Island. We have a great partnership with both the EMS and the hospital, and love working with you guys. So I'm going to allow Randy Nash and David Ketchum to introduce themselves.
Randy Nash, I actually work for a company called Air Methods. We're the vendor. We supply the helicopters, the pilots, and the mechanics. I've been at the Bellingham base now since 2004. Before that, I was a helicopter pilot with the Navy. I was the officer in charge of the Navy search and rescue unit there at Whidbey Island. So I've been flying out to Friday Harbor for a few years now. I'm basically here today to answer any questions regarding the aviation side of the house, traffic considerations, what we can do, minimize noise, flight paths, whatever else we can do here today.
Hi, my name is David Ketchum. It's very nice to be here. My wife and I recently sold our home on Whidbey Island, and we used to visit Friday Harbor and the islands up here very often. We've recently moved to Tucson, of all places, but it's one of those life's goals that we decided to do. So it's, again, very nice to be here. A little bit of background. I always hesitate to give a resume. It's kind of embarrassing, but on the other hand, you should probably know who you're listening to. So after I left the Air Force in 1972, I started a consulting firm for essentially fixed-wing flight operations on crew safety, FAA coordination, all kinds of flight operations issues. In about 1980, I started my business. I've worked for myself solely ever since I left the service. I started in about 1980 in the design area of my business, designing both airports and heliports, and I've done that continuously up until today. In about 2008, I dropped most of my airport design function and started focusing almost entirely on heliports, which I just got to the point where I enjoyed it very much. Most of my heliport work is for hospitals. I've done about, I'd say over, but I'm not sure how much, over 300 hospital heliports in my career. I especially enjoy those heliports that are in more rural areas because I can see the value of them. But I also have large heliport clients also. I did the current and the former heliports at Harborview Medical Center as an example. I've done all four heliports at Seattle Children's Hospital. The current rooftop heliport at Seattle Children's will give way to a brand new heliport at Seattle Children's one of these days when they get through building another tower. I do Cincinnati Children's Hospital. I've got projects all over the country and still enjoy it very much. So my focus in my heliport design is safety first, also functionality, paying attention to a design that works for pilots considering the ever-changing technology of what they use in the cockpit to stay safe. And I'm busy all the time. I have projects all over the place. I've been involved in this project as a consultant to Airlift Northwest since before Peace Island was built. In fact, the architect called me one time to come up and take a look at the original, at the site, considering the original concept drawings for the hospital. So I'm pretty well aware of what's been going on the island with respect to this. I have some slides to show today after Scott gets through with some opening remarks. They are more for discussion points and to try to answer any questions that you may have. But for the most, I'd like to be here to be a resource for you. I'm pretty well adept to have a good understanding of the flight operations issues, the facility issues, the cost issues, impacts, that sort of thing. So I'd like to be a real resource. The one thing I'd like to point out is that we talked about this on the way up, and that is that whatever the final decision is with respect to a heliport at Peace Island, I think all of us would be comfortable with it if it's based on an understanding of the facts as they truly are. In these kinds of situations, we find oftentimes that there's misunderstandings or misinformation, people not quite understanding the technicalities of things. that's not a good format within which to make decisions. So if we can help to be able to answer questions so that you're working with a good set of facts, we've done our job today. So it's nice to be here. Thank you very much.
So we intend for it to be a short presentation. I have a little bit of information to go over to share with you, and then have plenty of time for discussion. But if along the way, if you have a question, just raise your hand and we can have conversation as needed. One of the things that I think is important to point out is that Airlift Northwest, we've been serving patients for 37 years. We're always looking for ways to sort of improve the system. What we do is pretty much the same day in and day out, and we can identify little pieces that will help our patients. So adding blood product, bringing on NVGs, having GPS approaches, dedicated IFR corridors. You know, we're always kind of looking at things to improve within the system. And helipads and LZs are a big one that we look at. So, you know, just recently, within the last 3 or 4 years, Cascade Hospital and Forks Community Hospital have both had sort of an improvement or an installation of a helipad. And, you know, reaching out to those facilities, they've identified that as it's a big improvement, you know, to be able to have the aircraft come right in and the crew can move their stretcher and their equipment into the facility, get the patient transitioned, and be on our way. So it's, you know, we've looked at this in other areas, certainly. We want to help you guys become more familiar with, while we have the advantage of doing it every day, it's uncommon for you guys. Probably not used to helicopters as much. So I passed out some talking points. You guys have them in front of you. These are some of the sort of bullet points that we've talked about with amongst ourselves, with EMS, with Peace Island Medical Center, just in terms of an overview of the benefits of having a helipad adjacent to the hospital. Some of these are self-explanatory. They're, you know, kind of obvious, but I think that there's always a risk-benefit analysis, right? So I'm going to be pointing out the benefits, and then the risks are the other side of that equation. And then once I get done, David will be able to sort of really go through the design and engineering. He has some good slides to show you, some pictures of other facilities, and hopefully get as much information as we can to you. So obviously, bullet point number one is just reduce transport time. 3 years ago, I kind of did a deep dive into the data, and it was about a 19-minute turnaround time to go from helipad up to here. Then you have the time at the bedside, so that's excluded out of that 19 minutes. And then about, you know, the additional time to get back down to the aircraft. I looked at it over the last week, and the more current data is it's about 7 minutes. We've gotten faster, right? I mean, everything gets faster with time. But I think just, you know, in broad terms, it adds about 16 minutes to the transport. Having to land at an off-site helipad, come up, transfer the patient, and then go back to the helipad. That varies, you know, depending on weather, depending on EMS's availability to get to us, but on average, 15 to 16 minutes. The next bullet point, improved patient safety is one that I can speak to firsthand. Every time you transfer a patient from a stretcher to a gurney, or a gurney to a stretcher, you risk losing an IV, pulling them off the monitor, dislodging an ET tube. Each time you can reduce that transfer, it's a big benefit for the patient. And there have been some studies done on this that in the transport world, this is kind of where we make our money, is in these transition points. You know, once we get them in the ambulance, once we get them in the aircraft, everything's in a much more controlled setting, but it's that movement from stretcher to stretcher that is complicated. And so if we were able to land here adjacent to the ER, it would be our stretcher would go in, we'd move the patient over, and then the stretcher would go right to the aircraft, they'd be loaded into the aircraft. It's pretty simple. And we do that at a lot of facilities. I'd say the majority of the facilities we're able to take our stretcher right to the bedside. The next bullet point is reduced EMS out of service time. It's just acknowledging that San Juan Island EMS does send a rig down to get us. If they didn't have to do that, it would be, you know, free up some of resources for San Juan Island EMS. The next bullet point is just noting that I think as we think about this, it's really important to focus on the notion that there's certain patient populations that benefit from saving 15 minutes. It's not every flight, right? I mean, some flights are more routine, but in situations where it's trauma, cardiac, neuro, I would argue OB, time is of the essence. And we, you know, as crews, we really play into that. Every minute counts. I mean, we're shifting equipment and making radio calls and really trying to shave off 30 seconds sometimes. So to us, when we see, you know, a 15-minute slot, this is, that's wonderful. You know, it's a huge opportunity for improvement. And then the next bullet point kind of speaks to the same thing. And once we understand that there's certain patient populations that benefit from this, maybe there's times that the rotor wing aircraft is coming in and out of Peace Island Medical Center where we don't need to land adjacent to the ER. We could default to landing to the helipad at the airport, and on an as-needed basis, we'd land adjacent to the helipad. This is just, you know, I think you need to have all options on the table. And the children's helipad is an example of this. If we have a critical pediatric patient, we land right at children's. If it's more of what we could maybe term a routine transport, we'll land at Graves Field, which is just about 3/4 of a mile away. So it's just trying to accommodate the needs of the community, and it is a possibility. It's something to consider. Then the next bullet point is just, you know, that having a helipad right at the facility allows when San Juan Island EMS is not available, when there's, well, and also the next bullet point, a mass casualty, there's some reason that you guys need additional hands that airlift can send over, we can land right next to the ER and be in the ER, not have to rely on the ground transport. So that's, I think, just from a clinical perspective, those are the things that really stand out for me and kind of the important things to sort of consider as the big benefits of having a helipad adjacent to the ER. There is also in your packet just we put some numbers. This is just a really broad overview. The first page shows the last 2 years and 3 months of volume in and out of Peace Island Medical Center. It works out to be about 7 to 14 flights per month. So we're busier in the summer. There's more trauma in the summer. And that's been, you can see that's been pretty consistent over the last 2.5 years. Now, prior to Peace Island Medical Center being here, we came out closer to 20 to 30 times a month. It was almost a daily basis. So you can kind of see how that number's trended now. Then the next slide, the next page, is just a breakdown of what times of day we're coming out. I think somewhere in here it might have been interesting to see a trend like we mostly come out between the hours of 5 p.m. and 9 p.m. It's all over the map. you know, we're here in the middle of the night during the afternoons. But again, it's just another way to look at how frequently the aircraft is in and out of Peace Island Medical Center.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah,
about
absolutely.
Just some history. You know, so when PIMC was built, was this brought up as a consideration? It's just interesting now that after the fact the facility is operational, that
yes,
this is coming up now.
Yeah, and I don't have any personal background with that. David was involved with it. I was not the base manager at the time, but I do understand that it was.
I was actually one of the co-chair from day one with the Beeside Medical Center development. And it was a topic of discussion multiple times. We even considered putting it on top of the roof, which is pretty typical nowadays. You know, we were on the ragged edge of making it possible financially, just the overall facility, and to put it on the roof at that time frame was $350,000. It's probably a lot more now. And so that got bonked out. Then we reconsidered putting it in the southeast corner of this campus. And then it got sort of overshadowed by, hey, we already have one, and we need to spend money elsewhere to make this thing fly, no pun intended. So, yeah, it was, from the get-go, it was one of our considerations.
But it was decided against due to cost at that time.
Yeah, basically it was driven by cost. It wasn't doable, and it was competing with other needs that were more fundamental. And, you know, we were blessed at that time having a helipad, you know, down at the airport, so I'm pretty close right on Franklin Drive. So,
I respect the consideration of time. I just, you know, this eliminates some revenue for EMS.
Sure.
At this point, so I guess.
Any other questions at this point? Okay, let's have David, if you mind giving your portion.
I'll ask Carl to help me figure out what I'm going to get.
Some chairs.
I'm going to be at this table. I don't want to be here.
Do you want a chair, Commissioner?
So, David Ketchum has, I feel humbled in his presence. He's touched almost every helipad in the Pacific Northwest that we go in and out of. So, it's really nice to work with him, and he is a wealth of information in terms of the design and engineering.
Would you mind telling my wife that you feel in my presence?
Okay,
I appreciate that. Thank you. Let's grab my glasses here. I've recently gotten to the point where I require glasses to see things across the room, so I'm just going to humble myself and wear them. It's a fact of life, I guess. I have a few things to show you, and not knowing exactly how this meeting was going to pair out. I'd like to start with just a kind of a brief overview of Heliports and some of the administration, some of the issues relative to authority and jurisdiction and codes. And I won't belabor this, but I certainly don't want to bore you with it, but I think I'd like to kind of go through this a little bit. And if anybody has any questions as we go, please just let me know. Real briefly, from a code standpoint, in the United States, we categorize helicopters, and therefore, in many ways, heliports, into three different categories, H1, H2, and H3. We also subcategorize them as either ungrade or elevated. H1, H2, and H3 is basically a National Fire Protection Association distinction. I'm sure that the chief can mention here that NFPA is a code that most fire departments pay attention to in their building codes and when they're authorizing things. And these designations of H1, H2, and H3 have a whole lot to do with what facilities heliports have to have and how big they need to be in order to accommodate various different helicopters. The helicopters that most EMS organizations in this country fly, including Airlift Northwest, fall into what we call the H1 category, and that category is designated by the overall length of the helicopter. Okay, so we're dealing with H1 category helicopters. We also pay attention to whether or not, of course, we're on grade or elevated. That those drive code issues and expenses, as the doctor mentioned, and whether or not there's fueling or not. And in most EMS heliports, you won't find fueling as being an issue. At major bases, of course, it can be. The major jurisdiction we have then would be through the International Fire Code, International Building Code, and NFPA. The Department of Health obviously has a lot to say, too, about a design review. For grade level heliports, the IFC and IBC, their recommended point in their code is to have FAA approval.
That's in the building code. I will mention right now that the FAA does not approve or disapprove heliports of this category. These are considered private use for use of the owner and those designated by the owner. The other item that IBC and IFC require is an 80BC fire extinguisher. That's your only code item from IBC and IFC. NFPA grade level heliports with no fueling, which would be the category of a heliport for this hospital. One fire extinguisher, a no smoking sign. We also go for either UL or ETL listed components. That's so we make sure that when we go to the building official and they're looking at electrical safety, they make sure that the lighting in the heliport is not presenting a risk. So we look for either Underwriters Laboratory or ETL, which is another nationally recognized testing laboratory, mostly used for aviation lighting equipment. We want to make sure that the heliport has been approved by the authority having jurisdiction. We want to make sure that to the extent that it makes sense, that we're being consistent with the FAA's advisory circular on the subject. The FAA has no jurisdiction over the facility itself because they're private use heliports. They do have jurisdiction over the airspace, but it doesn't make sense not to pay attention to the FAA's recommendations with respect to the design. Let's see, above ground tanks, 50, I'm not sure quite why that's in there, so I'll just skip over that one for now. For this facility, the Department of Health, grade level H1 and no fueling. The Facilities Guidelines Institute is not regulatory in any way on this facility. We follow NFPA for the most part. That's where most of the detail is going to be as far as building code is concerned. I had talked way back when we were looking at the feasibility of the heliport here at Peace Island to Janet Smoot, who's an architect and senior plans person. She felt that the Department of Health would not have any issues with the heliport on site here. It goes back some, but that was her opinion. As I mentioned before, the FAA has no jurisdiction over what are categorized as private use or prior permission required. Same thing, heliports. If it does have jurisdiction over the airspace, there's an airspace process that we would go through. First of all, I would take a look and make sure that we have airspace from a heliport at the hospital that meets the FAA's criteria before we'd even put any documents into the FAA. But basically what would happen there is that we would put FAA documents into the FAA to get their opinion on airspace. They would obviously take a look at the proximity of the airport. And I'm pretty darn sure what they would say is we would like to see a memorandum of understanding between airport management and those who are managing the heliport to make sure that there are no safety conflicts, that you have procedures in place to be able to safely operate helicopters to an off-site facility, off-site meaning off of the airport, but in close proximity to the airport. So the FAA would then go through their 7040 DOS process, they would send us their comments, and we would hope then to get what they call a no objection letter, not an approval letter or a certificate, just a no objection letter. And most likely, again, they would recommend that we have a memorandum of understanding with airport management at the port. Town of Friday Harbor, I can remember talking, I don't know if Mr. Bertrand is still here, but talked to him at some time, probably 4 years ago. Well, this is actually 2016, but I talked to him prior to that also. And he was said that, and permitting is a big deal here, that the town would consider this as being a permitted accessory use. That's an important designation because if the town were to consider this heliport or a heliport that goes into the hospital as being a conditional use, then we go through the conditional use process. It tends to be fairly elongated, could be very expensive. A permitted accessory use is the relationship from a code a permitting standpoint that most hospital heliports have with hospital facilities. In other words, they're considered such an integral part of hospitals these days that they're not put into a separate category with respect to